time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 6th of August, 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Village Butchers. You'll find them at 102 Oceanview Road, Oneiroa. On Saturday, the 6th of August, I spoke to Don McKenzie from the local board, Hans vs. Lowe's on his book on punk subculture, and I talked with wine critic and broadcaster John Hawksby. The new change to our local governance structures and the creation of the local boards has meant a new planning regime, and those boards, those foundation boards really, are coming to grips with their responsibilities and what their vision is for the future of the island over the remainder of their term and beyond. And they've put that together, all of the boards are doing this, put it together in a document which is the draft local board plan, and it's open for submission. Submissions close on Monday, and I thought it was timely to look at that and get some ideas for, you know, what's in the plan and what are the various areas of interest and how you can go about having your say on that. And to speak with us about that is Don McKenzie, a member of the local board. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Chris. Nice to be here.
All right, so let's whip straight into it. So I'd like to know a little bit about the process of the development of the plan. So is this a document that council officers formulate and then the board tweak, or was it more of a kind of a brainstorm of ideas from the board members that shape the plan?
Well, now, before I answer that question...
Look, he's an articulate politician.
This is breaking news for Waiheke Radio, and I have to say that you're the first to know about this, that the library is now going to be a reality. The new library here on the artworks site... is now a done deal. So I think that's really great. It'll be the standalone single-story library on the old church site out the front of Artworks here. And that was just approved on Thursday when Faye, the chair of the committee, and I went to the Strategy and Finance Committee of the Council, the Auckland Council, and finally gained approval for this $5.1 million project. So that's really exciting, and I suppose in a way that tells us that the vision that the new local board had was right. We responded to the community's plea to separate the service centre from the library. We went through due process and have finally gained that capital project, which I think will be enormously important for Waiheke as a whole. But it'll be very important also for the artworks complex. I think it'll change the environment in this particular precinct, and it's going to help a great deal. So we're very excited about that, and very pleased to have had that win.
That has been a long time coming, hasn't it? So we've got the go-ahead on the library. That means the service centre, no word on what will happen with that? Does it just remain as it is?
Well, meantime, but of course it does in a way change the game plan, because what is now required is to get additional capital money to refurbish the service centre, or recraft it, rebuild it, redesign it, whatever is decided. But that's a natural corollary from the separation of the two projects, and therefore there'll be a need to go into bat for money for that as well. But it's certainly there's need for great redevelopment of the service centre, and so that will follow. But it will change the way in which perhaps some of the other capital works will be dealt with, and it'll have to stand in the queue with other priorities that the plan presents.
Right. So, because I mean, to go back to the plan, that that concept of a service centre isn't one of the priorities identified in there, is it?
No.
So we've got a bit of a gap there.
That's
now.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in this process of consultation then, does that also give the board the opportunity to have a second go at it and say, well, now we've heard about the library, we need to put the service centre in there as well?
In a way, yes, it does. So let's go just back through the process. When the board was elected in October last, it was very clear right from the very outset that one of the requirements of the board would be to develop a plan and an agreement on that plan with the governing council. So in January, February, March, the board put together a draft document. And then in April, May, that document went out for community engagement. And we had some 30 meetings with varying groups around the island. They were very good, excellent meetings. And as a result of the direction that the community gave us with respect to the very draft plan, we modified that. The board modified that over June, July. And now that plan is up for final formal consultation and goes through a particular process called the Special Consultative Procedure. And that's a reasonably formal process where submitters who wish to make further changes or commentary on the plan are able to do so. And that will take place Monday, August the 22nd, 23rd and 24th. But as you said at the outset, submissions close on the 8th of August at 4 p.m. Then we'll be able to line up and see how many submissions we get on that. The board has one final look at those submissions and modifies the plan and then submits by 31 October. And then that becomes part of the Auckland plan.
All right. So the plan itself, the draft plan, one of the issues with it, I think, isn't it, that it's not only a matter of what's in the plan, but it's also the relative priority which is given to the different aspects of it. And it's very difficult to assess that because most of the items are unbudgeted.
Correct. And we don't put, because the local board doesn't hold the budgets at this stage, and that's another point of contention, because you recall that from the very outset we said, local decisions made locally, and actually we need the money to be able to do it. Well, there's still a deal of debate and etc. going on around the degree of devolution that the governing council is prepared to give local boards. I think that's still a process that is undergoing some agonising, and so we have to wait and see. But I'm sure that all of that will come in time. It has to, because that's the way the legislation is shaped. But you're right. We can't actually put numbers, budgeting numbers against those priorities, and those are the matters that we're going to have to go in and bat for all over again. There are probably some fairly obvious things that need to be done, like stormwater management, protection of our habitat. Issues of that sort, because the thing I think that we all value is the special character of this place in which we have the privilege to live, and we've got to preserve that. But we live in a fool's paradise if we think that we can keep it the way it is forever, because we can't. And the trick for the board is to balance in a rational way as it can, development with those social and economic and environmental interests. And of course, it's the environmental elements of the island that are so precious.
Mm. So I wanted to delve into the plan or a few sections of it in a little more detail. So business development. Now, this is this area interested me because it seems that the approach that's been taken here is that business development, the approach is to build up some of the infrastructure that will attract tourists, and then the hope is that there's some kind of trickle-down impact on the businesses and economy of the island. Would that be a fair summation of the approach in that section?
It's one of the approaches, yeah. Eco-tourism is seen as being relatively valuable around the world, but I wouldn't say it's the only approach to economic and business development on the island by any means.
I mean, some of the other boards have taken an approach which is much more around, say, industry development and more looking at opportunities for developing new businesses, developing industry, perhaps looking at zoning issues and so on. But that kind of thinking doesn't really appear in this plan, does it?
Well, zoning issues are really often a matter of the district plan, and we're going to see the unitary plan evolve. So I think that's a matter that is yet in the wings. But essentially, business development has to come from business. The board can create the climate in which business evolves, and it's very keen to do so. But it can't, in a sense, lead the business development without some direction from that particular community. We haven't got film studios here that we can put up a case to buy, such as has just happened in West Auckland, for example. Have we got a boat building industry here, and so on? But there are other things that we need to think about. We need to think about, for example, land use and the rural landscape that we enjoy, and what's the best land use that we have to hand, and so on.
Okay, so let's take a look at, there's quite an emphasis in here on development of local facilities, so proposals to build a community house, looking at a swimming pool perhaps, a new arts complex, and so those are all quite ambitious projects, and I presume there's kind of various levels. You know, some of them are about investigation and some of them are about let's go ahead and do this. What about our existing facilities? Has there been any thought about, you know, upgrade or say repurposing of existing community facilities?
I guess that's a matter of timing and strategy, and that's where prioritisation becomes sort of quite important, because business has to continue as usual, activity has to continue as usual. But at the same time, we have to have some sense of being able to develop these facilities. If we take artworks, for example, there are some very important activities that are going on within artworks as it currently exists, and it would be a great shame if any of that fell away. But wouldn't it be very nice to have the vision, the actuality of a new complex in which some of those cultural activities could flourish even more? Last night I went to the Fiddler on the Roof. What a great show that was, and what talent we have on this island. And in a way, I suppose the theme of that show is pretty much the challenge of tradition on the one hand, and then the need to change on the other. And that's not too unlike what we're facing here. And let's hope we can do it in a much kinder and gentler and more productive way.
Okay, so discussion of the fiddler on the roof kind of prompts me to and the last section I'd like to look in a little more detail, which is the art section. What do we call it here? Arts and culture. And also, this might serve as an example as well for a question I have around the way the set out of the thing. So for each of the key projects or initiatives, there's an estimated timing. So in here, we've got support for arts programs to enhance cultural and artistic expression. Estimated cost $100,000. But there's an estimated timing of 1 to 10 years. So can you explain what that means?
Well, it means the evolution of what the community wishes in terms of artistic expression. How is this to play out? If in fact we are to have an art complex, are we looking at somewhere where this artistic activity should be centralised, and where there are synergies to be had, where people can go and know that there is a variety of artistic expression and engagement and participation? Or are we looking at a series of decentralized activities? Where should the money go? Mm-hmm. There are community galleries around, and various initiatives on the part of entrepreneurial artists and so on. And should they be given some room in the sun as well, and how do we do that? And we need to talk about that. So, and I think that what you would find in something like arts and culture, it, like actually every other area, is constantly evolving. Things are always evolving, mm-hmm. and so therefore, you one of the challenges of any local government is to move with the times and move with the activities that the community is giving expression to.
So, I'm still just wondering a little bit around how the budgeting works. So, there's an estimated cost for supports for arts programs of $100,000. Is that $100,000 a year? Is that $100,000 over the term of the plan? Or, because it says estimated timing is 1 to 10 years, I'm just wondering how long, you know, is that $100,000 over 10 years? I'm not really sure how that works.
Well, I think we should be looking at these things in the terms of 1 to 3 years. there is some difficulty here because we're feeding, on the one hand, we're feeding into the long-term Auckland plan that the mayor gave expression to just last Thursday, which focuses on transport. But then this plan here is more focused on the 1 to 3 year staging of development from a Waiheke perspective. So that's where we've tried to keep reasonably practical in terms of what it is that will help build the strength of this community on the one hand in a relatively short-term span of 3 years, but at the same time giving some indications of where Waiheke expects to be in 10 years as well, right, as part of contributing to the long-term plan of Auckland. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit vague, and as I say, it's complicated by the fact that we don't hold the budgets and we have to go cap in hand for particular projects. And we're going to have to, as a result of putting this plan in place, we're going to have to come out with which projects we're going to push for.
One of the issues which has been of a lot of interest in the arts community on the island is in this arts and culture a part of the plan. Three-fifths of the total indicated budget, where there is pricing, is earmarked for one project, to commission a sculpture on Ocean View Road. $150,000 earmarked for that one piece of art, compared to the $100,000 earmarked for supporting cultural and artistic expression in various groups. That's a lot of money to spend on one art piece.
That sum was put against that project from that was not the board's desire. As I said, we don't have any say whatsoever with respect to the allocation of funds to any particular project. And we need to go back here and just talk about the way council allocates its spending. And we even need to go further back, because there are many people in the community who say that councils and ratepayers' money shouldn't be spent on issues of the sort at all. And we need to be taking that into account as well. So there is a body of opinion that says that's not the job of local councils. And we have to acknowledge as well that there is a debate between central government and local government about where rates and taxes, what taxes pay for and what ratepayers pay for and so on. But all of that aside, the jam jar from which that money would come, if it does, would be out of the arts and cultures jam jar in the council's larder. And if we don't spend it, somebody else will on some other artistic venture. Now, your audience will know that there are some very talented sculptors on this island who are at this moment opening up some sculptures in Auckland to which they've contributed, and that will have come, the spending on those arts icons, I suppose you might say, have that are an expression of our fundamental culture of mana whenua and oftentimes and so on. That comes out of the council's arts and culture jam jar, and if we don't spend it, somebody else will. So I just go back to the fundamental thing that we don't set the sums at this stage against those particular projects, and if we are offered that and we turn it down, then the money will go elsewhere.
Well, that's very interesting. That's given me an understanding of this plan development, which it certainly didn't have before, and I think it puts quite a different slant on the angle that people need to be taking in terms of their submissions. So people have a couple more days, don't they? So they need to be in by Monday, is that right?
That's right, 4 o'clock Monday. So even today you can slip down to the library and get a copy and do an online. You might even get one in the post tomorrow and get there by Monday. But yes, you still have time to make submissions. We're still very keen to hear. Remember, it's a formal process. You have to say whether you wish to appear before the local board and council with your submission, well argued and reasoned and so on, or whether you just want it to be a written submission. But all input is welcome. Look, everybody who has a view about these things should give expression to it, because the community is yours, it's mine, it belongs to all of us, and what comes out of these plans depends on the input that goes into it. So go to it.
Well, thank you very much, Don. And as Don says, that is available at the library, or go to aucklandcouncil.govt.nz and dig around. You'll find the plan on there and also the submission form. So, yeah, certainly very, very important that you get in there and have a say about some of those issues. It's going to have a big impact on what happens on our island over the coming years. It's Don McKenzie from the local board. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Susie and the Banshees, Hong Kong Garden. Perfect introduction for my next guest, who's Hans Versloes, who's the author of a book, London's Burning, an exploration in punk subculture. Good morning, Hans.
Good morning, Chris.
So this book is you're publishing it now, but it has origins in the past, doesn't it?
Yes, it was my thesis for my BA in sociology in 1980. that I had to write to get a degree in sociology. So at the time, I did this at the University of Antwerp in Belgium, and it was written in Dutch. And it was only published then in photocopy form. And but people here in New Zealand have been asking me for so long, can we please read it? So I had some time in the last 12 months to actually translate it and then actually publish it properly.
Good stuff. Now, I'm just going to ask you to pull a little bit closer to the microphone there just to help us out there. So when you wrote this, were you in London? Were you immersed in the punk subculture?
No, I lived in Belgium, but I travelled to London quite a bit to do research and to, you know, do total immersion, basically.
Yeah, yeah, a good excuse to go to a few punk gigs.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And what were your favourites back in the day?
Wire and Susie and the Banshees, of course, very good, but I never actually saw them. Joy Division, which was a bit later, but it was originally part of that whole scene as well. So, yeah, those were the two of my favourites.
Excellent. Now, so when you were writing your thesis, I mean, was it really just you thought, well, I love this stuff, so this is a good excuse, or was there something else that drew you to it?
Well, the university or you know, my lecturers and tutors allowed me to tackle this subject, so I was really happy to do that. So it was great for my motivation to actually make a go of it and do a really good job. So I was really very happy to you know, to do something, to write something about my own life, basically, and link it to the study I did then.
What about the punk scene in Belgium?
Well, it was quite developed as well, and it because it's not very far from England, it's only across the Channel, and we had access to British radio, so we could listen to John Peel and his new music that he promoted very much as one of the first DJs in the world to actively support the punk scene. So Belgium was very much at the forefront as well. We had lots of punk bands and gigs and clubs where punk rock music could be heard.
Yeah, well, were the X?
They were Dutch.
Yeah, Dutch, right, okay. Yeah, Plastic Bertrand is the only one that didn't notice that. Yeah.
Yes, he must be about the most internationally known, it's more new wave than punk rock, of course.
But I still remember that song being a lot of fun when it was playing on TV here back then.
Ça plane pour moi.
Yeah. Right, so, okay, so you were getting around, and so your research, I presume, how did you go about researching this?
Well, it was actually quite difficult to research it theoretically because it was so new. There was simply very little available for me to consult, you know, read about it, or there was only the raw press material that was, of course, completely distorted reportage about all the violence and all the stuff that was surrounding punk that was sort of very negative in the mainstream, you know, especially tabloid reporting. But there was, of course, a lot of local fanzines that punks wrote themselves, so there was a lot of material available that way, but I still had to, you know, dig it out and try to find it. And of course, all the music wasn't very readily available either, because there was no such thing as the internet or MP3 players or sharing of files or anything like that. So music was either live or on cassette form or little record labels that were willing to release punk rock records. It was always very difficult, even, you know, for the big bands like the Sex Pistols. It took them ages to find a record label that would actually put out their music without any censorship. So
and what was it that you were exploring most? Was it the do-it-yourself nature of it, the rebellion, or the mock rebellion, or, you know, what was it you were looking at?
I think the rebellion was real. It wasn't mock. There was a lot of art involved as well, but the whole scene attracted me because it was very new and very exciting and interesting on a lot of levels. And it was, of course, a new subculture. You had, you know, the Teddy Boys and the Mods and the Skinheads before, and this was, you know, one step further. And so because it was very new, I did place it in that context of earlier British subcultures, as you know, how the press treated earlier subcultures and how the press now treated punk in the same way, as a sort of a moral panic. Society is going to end because these young people are running riot, and they have yellow hair and they or green hair, and they go around and beat everybody up, and they have violence at all their concerts and everything. And everything. So all that sort of distortion was very much my focus of repairing that, and to look at it from a more distant perspective in the greater context of this whole subcultural revolutionary movements that have happened before.
All right, so we might take a listen to a song now, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about, you know, you're revisiting your thesis. I mean, I don't know, if I look back at the things I wrote at university, I kind of cringe, so I want to talk about that a little bit. I'm talking to Hans Versloos about his new book, London's Burning, An Exploration in Punk Subculture, Joy Division being one of Hans's favourites from back in the day. So we talked before the song about how this book originated as your thesis in 1980, and I was saying, you know, if I look back at stuff I wrote at university, I kind of go, oh dear, you know, was I really kind of that worthy and pious? So, I mean, you must have gone through a similar kind of experience revisiting this.
Yeah, it was quite strange to look back on your, you know, 21-year-old self and what you were obsessed by and what you wanted to do and your ambitions and your anger at the time too. So I hope it's still readable like that, and it reflects very much its time. I've made a literal translation. I didn't edit anything from the Dutch version into English, so it reads as it was written then. And I've only added some recent literature since 1980, because so much has been written about punk rock, and probably so much better than that, than the book, and also a lot of web references are now available. You can watch some wonderful homemade punk rock or punk videos of people walking down the King's Road in London in glorious Super 8 Technicolor. It's really on YouTube. It's really beautiful. So all those references are in the book now as well, which I've added.
So you must look, I mean, as you say, punk rock has been so written about and so examined, and, you know, like the story of the Sex Pistols, the story of the outrage has just been retold so many times over the past 30 years. You must have quite a different viewpoint on punk and punk subculture now, with the hindsight of 30 years, than you did when you wrote this in 1980.
I'm still surprised on how influential it is, the whole scene of doing things yourself in music, in literature, in filmmaking, in all kinds of arts forms, in radio, how it still reverberates in contemporary culture. So I'm really pleased that it's still relevant, like a lot of subcultures in the past, like, say, Teddy Boys, or have completely disappeared because it is simply has no link to our own existence now. But if you look at Waiheke Radio or local radio, it is all do-it-yourself ethos. So I think that was the mainstay of the punk legacy, is that we can still, or we should still, do things ourselves, be it in radio, television, on the internet, making your music, doing your art, or whatever. And I think that's still important. So in that sense, I'm quite pleased, and I hope that my book is a kind of a primer for people who want to know what it was like at the time, so they can make those links themselves to contemporary culture.
And you've got an event on the 20th to launch the book?
Yes, it's the official launch in 2 weeks' time at the Waiheke Art Gallery at Saturday the 20th of August at 2 p.m. And you're all most welcome to attend. I've got a few books for sale there, because the book is actually published by myself. I don't have a publisher, I don't have a distributor. It's all on the internet. So if you ordered a book on the internet, it gets printed for you individually. But I have a few copies here that I will be able to provide and sign, and happy to chat to everybody who comes along.
So how did you find that self-publishing process?
I just looked it up on the internet, yeah. You know, as you do. And it's the company is called CreateSpace in the United States, which is, I think, a subsidiary of Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure how the business links are there, but they allow you to publish whatever you like in whatever format you like, whatever font, the size of the book, everything you have to do yourself. You send them the files, and they print it for you at a really cheap rate. And then they also offer marketing opportunities through Amazon. It gets an automatic site on Amazon.com, on all the, even the German and the UK and the Japanese sites. And then they also offer marketing channels to internet bookshops. And so it's available all around the world, and it gets printed on demand. It doesn't sit on a shelf somewhere in a warehouse. That's the beauty of, the technology these days.
And it's available as an ebook, I see, as well.
Yes, yeah. On Kindle only.
Yeah.
Which is a different process of publishing, but yeah. Yes, it is.
Good stuff. All right, so that's the 20th of August, 2 p.m. at the gallery, and you'll be spinning some tunes as well.
I won't, but my friend Peter Mack from Bass FM will.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Hans.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So the easiest way for people to get that, Amazon? Or yes. Or the gallery?
Yes.
Yep. Excellent. I'm joined now by John Hawksby, a name that will be familiar to many of you, and as a broadcaster, a wine critic, a man around the island involved with many of the charities. And in fact, John has just became just had his investiture as a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to broadcasting and community. So good morning, John.
Good morning, Chris. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, that's lovely to have you here. So what do you consider yourself to be these days? Are you a broadcaster, a wine critic, a charity worker?
I'm sort of in that twilight zone of nothingness, really. I have 11 grandchildren, so they take up quite a bit of time. I suppose I'm in that sort of twixt and between. I'm not really retired. I think to retire is to give up, really. You need a reason to get out of bed in the morning. So I suppose my primary focus is wine writing. I'm the wine editor, which is a grand name given to me for 5 different publications. I actually don't edit anything. I do all the writing. So it's a bit like saying you're the CEO, but in fact you sweep out the factory. So writing takes up quite a bit of time, and then I talk about wine on 2 networked radio stations, News Talk ZB and national radio. So you don't all do that off the top of the head. I have a set topic for national radio. It's driven by a chef. They have a chef on first on a Monday, and then I've got to match the wines. That's my job. So it's driven by the food, really, on the Saturday News Talk ZB. I can drive that. I can talk about what I like, but you don't just talk off the top of the head. So a good deal of my week is probably spent in relation to either writing or prepping for that. Looking after grandchildren. I have the world's smallest vineyard, very tiny. I've got 5 acres, lifestyle block, no life, no style, bit of lawn mowing, stuff like that. And the community work, it sounds grand and whatever. I've done it for years. People think I'm unemployed, so they say, oh, he'll be available, he'll do it, and I have trouble saying no. So there's a bit of that. And family takes up quite a bit of time, and as you know, Waiheke's a purpose destination. So most of my grandchildren, except for 2 who live in Christchurch, the other 9 live in Auckland, and quite often they're saying, oh, can I go to, you know, Poppers and Ganmar's for the weekend? So you go and get them on the Friday, they stay for the weekend, and there goes the weekend, which is good. They come to us. So yeah, it's, I don't know, the week just steals on by.
So I mean, you've been involved with in broadcasting for quite a while, but obviously the bug's
since
got
1969.
Yeah.
Long before you were born.
Yeah. No, about the same time, actually.
Oh, okay,
yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you look very young for your age.
Oh,
must be
you.
The island life.
Yes, I think so. So, but you've still got the bug. I mean, what is it that keeps you going with that?
I think radio gets into the system, definitely. Radio is a glorious medium. It's this leap into the abyss, really. And I always preferred it to television, which is very controlled and contrived. And although it's nice to be on television and you get to dress up from time to time, you're the last domino to fall. So you're at the behest of a whole raft of people, which is fine. I quite like, you know, people controlling your destiny. But you have greater freedom, greater scope for originality and creativity on radio, because you turn on the microphone and there's just emptiness, really. So fill the void, paint the picture, theatre of the mind stuff. So radio is a more exciting medium to be involved in.
Another ex-broadcaster on the island, Barry Jenkin. Once told me that...
Good evening, citizens.
That's it, yeah. Well, he once told me that anyone who says they quit television is a liar.
I've known a few people that that quit, had enough.
You haven't felt like going back to that?
Nobody's come knocking on the door, to be perfectly honest. I have been asked to appear on a couple of shows, which given the concept and the script and whatever, I didn't think was A, appropriate, or B, me, and I felt it looked a bit too try hard. I think television is a medium that is pretty much given over to time and place and to youth. Having said that, radio sadly is going a bit the same way. And what everybody wants is bright, energetic, enthusiastic 24-year-olds with 30 years experience. Well, they don't exist. And I think it's a shame, really, that we put out to pasture some of our best broadcasters, both in radio and television, because they have a lot to offer. Whether they reach a stage where they've been around so long they're being paid too much, or whether there is, you do have a shelf life, I've no idea. But if the right opportunity came up, I mean, I've looked at a couple of things with a couple of people. Funding hasn't come through for a bit like James and Oz's wine tour, but do it in New Zealand, where you go around vineyards, you meet various people, talk about wine, could be beautifully shot and so on. And I've been approached by two different producers. Would I be interested? Well, yes, I would. But nothing's come to that. But I'd rather be out in the field than in the studio. I'm 64 in a week's time. Nobody wants to see 64-year-olds on the telly, pretty much. Having said that, you've got your David Attenboroughs and so on. Highly skilled people, but you know, they just want to see young, fresh faces. And to be fair, I'm my television career spanned 30 years. That's enough. Move over, pal. Make room for the next generation.
Ian Johnston, someone you'll be familiar with, you know, another ex-broadcaster. I mean, he's quite damning in his critique of the broadcasting, you know, both in television and radio, I think, but especially television. You know, and what he's seen, you know, and you've worked in private and public radio, state and private television. I mean, what's your take on the? I mean, you've commented a little bit about it, but overall, your views on the state of media or television?
Well, I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man. You always come across sounding, oh well, your time has passed. You had your shot at it. Move over, and I think that's fair enough. I'm aware of Ian's comments and criticism, and he's quite right. You cannot buy history, and you cannot buy that sense of having seen things evolve and develop. And it is hard to watch some television hard news stories, and everybody seems to be 12 asking the questions, and you just know they have no idea. Not that you need a sense of history. I mean, you can't. I mean, I was a young broadcaster at one stage, and older guys, you know, from generations before me, probably said the same about me. And of course, you can come up to speed, but experience is a very, very valuable asset to have, even if you use that experience behind the scenes. I mean, it's very hard for me, quite frankly, to listen to commercial music radio these days because of the inanity. And the madness and the craziness and the stupidity of 22-year-olds, to be perfectly honest. That's not critical of the young generation. It's just the super high jock thing. You know, hey, whatever, what the hell was that? Now, excuse me, I've never played so many CDs in the privacy of my own home. I don't want to be talked down to. Having said that, in my own time, I probably talk down to people. I don't know. But I do get the feeling that very often a lot of commercial radio in particular is it's all by rote. There's no room for creativity or individuality. There is in some stations, but it got, I mean, I worked on Radio Hauraki, More FM, classic hits and whatever, and I could see it coming where the accountants took over. Everything was bottom line and everything was liner radio. You had a three-hour show and every word that you would utter, apart from what the temperature was, because that fluctuated, was written for you. And you got sick of saying, hey, classic hits, we play the greatest songs of the set. What? I just wanted to shoot myself, you know.
Now, but earlier than that, I suppose, you received a bit of acclaim for some of your radio work in the days of Reflecting On, was it?
Yes. My initial radio work was done with an organisation that I helped put together called Christian Broadcasting Association in the late 60s. And it was Christian, but it was very low-key and it wasn't religious. And what we did was our first programmes were on Radio Hauraki when it was a pirate radio station. And the last thing they wanted was anything quasi-religious or Christian. But what we did was we took, well, Beatles songs at the time or the Stones, and we used the music they were playing, and a lot of it was quite reflective and revolutionary at the time, and we set it to themes that related to young people. Now, I was only 19, 20 when we were doing this, and we put these programs together in the basement of somebody's home, very makeshift. I mean, you were saying, you know, here we are, Waiheke Radio, it's a bit, you know, number eight wire. Let me tell you, this is very sophisticated to what we were doing. But we'd record the programs and they were flown out to the pirate ship Hauraki and they were played. And they dealt with themes that were relevant to young people at the time. Alienation, my parents have divorced, I feel suicidal, my life's going nowhere. And we had an off-air counselling service. Later we did a similar program on Radio New Zealand at nights. They gave us 3 hours on a Sunday night, 7 to 10. We'd go live, we'd interview people. But it was very low-key, but it was faith meets humanity meets help meets without throwing anything down your throat. So, and we'd play a lot of music and it would be relevant to the theme. And it's funny, we used to laugh because I remember in the course of a number of years, I think we won 18 mobile radio awards as they were then, and we could never win best religious program. We'd win best production, best documentary, best spoken program, best technical production, best creativity, best... The category we were supposed to be in, although we didn't think so, was we could never win that. And we worked on the premise that people tune out or switch off Christian radio stations, not because they're Christian, but basically because they're not radio. So we did what we felt was good radio first. So they were well scripted, well presented, had brilliant people voicing the stuff, Tom Bradley, Judy Bailey, people that I was working with at the time. So they were done very professionally and they were done very carefully. And I felt that was worthwhile. Looking back on my broadcasting career, radio and television, what did I leave behind to grow? What had the most merit? Well, that did. Why? Because it was interactive radio and it worked and people would phone in. The counselling was off air. We always had three. We called it the Talk About It phones. You could call from anywhere in New Zealand. It was toll free. And you could call and speak to a trained counsellor. So you felt that the program, it was igniting response, and I felt that that was really, really worthwhile. So looking back, yeah. I mean, you can do telethons till the cows came home. I did It's in the Bag for 5 years. I loved it. It was great. You visit every small town, money or the bag. Great, whatever. But at the end of the day, you read the news. It's all gone by tomorrow. It's in the ether. It's nothing, really. It's fun. It paid well. And I had met a lot of fabulous people and so on. But at the end of the day, I think, without sounding too bleeding heart, yeah, I think you want to leave something behind. You want to contribute something somewhere in the community and say, well, what did I do any good anywhere out there?
Well, a part of, I mean, the second part of your honour, is that what they call it, an honour?
Yeah.
I was looking up online last night, actually, to find out whether I should call you sir or not.
No.
But I don't.
No. I get called love things. I am finding a bit of curtsying and bowing in the village, though,
right,
which is very nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I say, the second part of that, aside from the broadcasting, was community work. Mm. And you do a lot of work for charity and community organisations. Is there a particular passion or issue that you follow that you're particularly interested in?
Yes, there is. Anything to do with children, is I've been particularly, I mean, you have your own children and then your grandchildren and so on, and all of my children and about half my grandchildren at some stage have finished up at the Starship Children's Hospital. It's inevitable. Anything to do with child cancer, anything to do with any aspect of the vulnerable and those that don't have a voice, I think you're particularly want to say yes to. But I'm from the slightly old school and from that biblical premise, if you like, and this has to do with faith and my Christian belief, which is not tied to strong religious or church going, but just basic decent human values and ethics, which you don't need to embrace Christianity to have, you know, I hasten to add. But of whom much is given, much will be required, is the premise. I've had a very good run. I've had a great life. You've got to give something back. So people ring, and I have trouble saying no, and most of the time, if I can do it and get there, I'll say yes. So if it's Ronald McDonald House, or it's something, you know, it doesn't have to be worthy. I mean, I often MC the launch of the sculpture on the gulfs every second year, and they say, John, will you come and MC this? You know, you're not getting paid, you know, but whatever. So you give up an evening, but it's fun. It's okay. That's good. I've done a number this year of fundraisers for Christchurch. I've still got some more coming up. I've got family living in Christchurch. I don't do it because I've got family living in Christchurch. I've been down there. It's a mess. It continues to be a mess. Those people are resilient and whatever. Of course you say yes. I mean, sometimes you just get three nights in a row and then you get the fourth call and you just say, to be perfectly honest, can I look at it next year? I'm done. You've got to have some time for yourself, to be perfectly honest. So I'm not a do-gooding junkie, but yeah, I think you contribute where you can. But anything, short answer, anything to do particularly with children.
Do you get political requests? I mean, a lot of broadcasters do, you know. I mean, you know, Paul yes. Henry, John Banks.
Yeah, I've been offered, they've been paid jobs, actually, from I can think of three political parties over the years that have said, would you come and MC our campaign launch, or where Prime Minister's going around the country speaking, we'd like you to come and MC it. We don't know what your political bias is, but we will engage you as an MC. I've always turned those down, even though they pay quite well. Because even although they say we don't care what your political bias is, by being on the platform, it's perception. So I like to be apolitical. So I've said no to them, even though they're well paying. Having said that, there is the Prime Minister's Fund for Christchurch, and I've been approached to, I've already done them, MC a couple of fundraising dinners. This was immediately after the big one, and they said, look, we're doing this. One was at Grand Harbour Restaurant, whatever. They did this thing. They raised $210,000. Prime Minister turned up. We auctioned a couple of bottles of his wine and so on, and they said, look, the funds are going to the Prime Minister's relief fund for Christchurch. Well, I don't see that as political, you know, but if it had been Phil Goff's or the Green Party's, who cares? Everything's off the table. You do it for the event.
So no one's approached you to go on the list?
I have been approached by two different political parties, and I've been approached twice to run for the Auckland mayoralty, which
it was nice to
be asked, but I just thought you're on a hiding to nothing here.
Yeah, because you've taken an interest in particularly the Matiati area.
Yes, indeed, I have, and I'll be taking an interest in the marina as well.
What's your take on that?
My take on that is that it shouldn't happen. Yeah, to be perfectly honest, I think leave it be. I've got the ghost of Sylvania Waters. I've got the ghost of everywhere else. I've got the ghost of Gulf Harbour. I think part of the natural attraction of Waiheke, and particularly the Gateway, is the fact that it looks kind of feral and kind of oldie-worldie. And I think that's the way it personally should stay. Now, I realise I'm going to upset a lot of people. Some of my best friends want the mooring in the marina, and it's being driven by a neighbour of mine who's a good friend, and we continue to chat and say we're going to agree to disagree on this one, and I'm going to be on any opposing party. I've said I'll put my hand up to to oppose it. But as somebody has pointed out to me, at least it's a local initiative. At least it's being driven by locals. It's not being driven by the city. And I can understand people who've got boats that want a marina. I personally think Matiatia is the wrong place for it. It's busy enough now. And all the promises in the world about no, it won't affect traffic and it won't, is, as we all know, utter nonsense. It's reasonably chaotic at busy times down there now. Let's leave it pristine. Let's leave it as it is. But if there is allowance within the scheme and if they're able to push it through legitimately and lawfully, there's not much you can do. I personally think it's an aberration and stupid. But, you know, I'm not going to be lying my body down in front of the bulldozers. If they're allowed to do it and can get the consents, it's all very wonderful. I'm slightly amused by the fact that I would have thought there was at least some Maori burial ground or some reason that it couldn't be done, but it seems to be, all of a sudden, no, it seems to be okay. And I'm thinking here, why is this? I smell a rat.
Yes, well, there's always people smelling rats around the island. I think the island way.
I think, you know, yeah. Is money changing hands here? I don't know. I wouldn't like to cast aspersions, but I'm...
But you just have.
But, you know, I'm just thinking, hang on just a minute. You know, there's got to be reasons we can't disturb that. But all of a sudden, you know, so I was hanging my hat on Ngāti Pauā or whatever, being able to say, hey, look, this will be a...
Damn, I've got to get involved myself.
This will be a walk in the park, but yeah, I'll throw... And I'm happy to be involved. Yeah. But as I say... If there's an allowance and if they can meet the requirements, at the end of the day, you know, it's very hard to take on City Hall. Having said that, we did it before and it was quite costly, but it can be done. But I'm not quite sure what the allowance is. I'm keen to ring up Mike Lee and say, can we not have Matiatia classified under whatever it is, not historical places, but I'm sure there's some marine aspect.
Yeah.
We may have left that too late, but I'm not losing sleep over it, but yeah, you asked me my take on it. I don't think it's appropriate.
I just wanted to finish off by going back to wine.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got a huge passion for wine. Now, is that something that you've always had, or did that kind of come about after you left television?
That came late, Chris. No, it came during my television career. I was sort of teetotal, sort of, slightly lapsed teetotal, up until about age 30, to be perfectly honest. Not from any religious sense or whatever. The wine culture was not part of my family growing up. And the wines during my time as a young person and into my 20s, the wines weren't that flash, to be perfectly honest. Montana, Blenheimer and Cold Duck wasn't cutting the mustard. I never was part of the beer drinking culture, although I played rugby league for the Ellerslie Eagles, where, you know, and league was very associated with a beer culture in the 50s and 60s. Didn't appeal to me. And mates saying, oh man, I got wasted last night. Oh, I was so sad. I just could not connect with that. And then I discovered wine in the mid-80s, and in Hawke's Bay we went to a wine tasting at Tomato. We were doing It's in the Bag, and we had an afternoon off. We went some wine tasting, and I tasted a Tomato Coleraine, and I thought, that's a beautiful wine, and I ordered a case, and that got me started on New Zealand wines in particular. And now I read widely and spent far too much money on wine. I love food as well, you see, so I see there's synchronicity there, food and wine. And Waiheke is, you know, it's all about wine, really. Well, it's not all about wine, but this is a lovely place to make good red wines in particular, and I think the wine culture for the island is quite important.
And you've got them boots and all. I mean, you're making wine as well, aren't you?
Well, yes, but I only very tiny. I only have 1,000 vines, and I don't make it commercially. I don't sell it. When you write about it, you ought not to sell it as well. So I just give it away to friends and family. Each vintage is named after a grandchild. A photo of the grandchild is taken in the vineyard. That is made into the label, and they get a few cases put down, you know, aside by myself and their parents for when they're 20 or 21 or whatever. And quite a few bottles go to charities, quite frankly, because you can't buy it. And because people think if I've made it, it was actually made at Stony Ridge on the island, it must be good. And because...
Is it good?
Yes, it is good. It is good. And I joke and I say the cost per bottle is $3,600 a bottle because it's such a small production. If I threw in the cost of the land, that's about what it costs. So people say to me, can I buy your wine at cost, John, for a charity function? I say, oh, that's fabulous. Yes, it's true. Nobody's going to buy it. So, yeah, so I just, it's just a fun, I call it expensive landscaping. It looks lovely. It's just nice. But, yeah, it's not a commercial thing. But it's kind of nice to see the evolution and to see how the wine is made and the work and the effort that goes into it. So if you're writing about wine, you might as well see it from the grassroots up and see how the process evolves and see what takes place. Yeah.
And so, do you think Waiheke's got it right in terms of its wine approach and its link to tourism? And
absolutely. Yeah. 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 I couldn't agree more. I do. I think it's got its... you've got to hang your hat on something. And there's no Auckland wine culture now. There used to be. West Auckland used to be the place to go, but that's been run over. It's suburban now. So you've got to go to Matakana. So Auckland's a lot closer. So if Aucklanders want to embrace a wine culture that's part of their environment, part of their territory, Waiheke, 35 minutes on the ferry, is the place to be. So, yes, no, we've got it right. Syrah's the new darling for the island, and that's probably the way to go. It suits our soil, it suits our climate, and those red Bordeaux blends that we're doing and some Chardonnays are absolutely fabulous. And this, I talk, you know, wine writers, we talk amongst ourselves, and for a number of years, they looked a bit down the nose at Waiheke. They said, oh, you know, overpriced and overhyped and over there. But they've changed their mind in the last couple of years because we have got a number of small boutique producers who are doing extraordinarily fine wine. And Vine Age has helped, and better viticultural practices have helped. And the wine that is coming, some of the wine that is coming from this island, I could name five or six producers that are really quite world-class and certainly value for money.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. We're near to, almost at the end of our show, so we need to wrap it up. But thank you so much for coming in. And congratulations again on your investiture, a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit. It sounds very...
Yeah, it does sound very whatever. And I, to be honest, when I first got the letter and said, you know, you've got this, I thought, oh, I was trying to be too cool for school and, oh, yeah, whatever, whatever. But when you actually go to Government House and there's a very moving ceremony and they put this rather nice medal on you, whatever, you go, oh, yeah, I'm feeling quite good about this. So I'm having to rethink my ideas on republicanism.
Yeah, it challenges that.
Yeah,
it's pathetic.
Yeah. You're anti-royalty until they give you something. You go, oh, that was quite nice. Quite like the pomp and ceremony.
Yeah.
I'm such a shallow person, Chris.
Oh, thank you very much, John. Okay, so we're just going to play a song now from Bob Dylan, and then
You're a good boy. You knew that.
Yeah, I just picked it.
Yeah, no, anything from Bob's acceptable.
Yeah, and then we'll come back and sum up the show. You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.